I fell in love with Wimbledon the very first time they sent me over in 1979. And Bud Collins and Donald L. were doing the telecast then. And they just sent me over. I was, in NBC's eyes, their number one man at the time. And they just wanted, since they were going to televise the event live for the first time, they wanted my presence there. Bud could have destroyed me. He could see that I was eventually going to probably move him over a chair. But he was as generous as he's been to everyone that shows any love for the game of tennis.
Hey everyone, John Worth, I'm here. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. It is Thursday. I'm here with my lovely producer, Jamie Lasanti. We have a very special guest this week, the great Dick Enberg. As many of you know, he just closed out his career, an absolute first ballot Sports Media Hall of Fame career, almost 60 years in all sorts of capacities, all sorts of sports. You will not find a more versatile play-by-play man, and you also won't find a nicer guy or a better writer. I think you'll get a sense from this conversation of just what a lovely human being we're talking to here. It was an honor to have known him while he was at the top of his game in sports media. It sounds as though he's got some great plans for what to do in this next chapter of his life. Apart from covering Super Bowls and Final Fours and Olympics and all sorts of other events, he also covered 28 Wimbledons and for a long time was the voice on center court along with Bud Collins. And it was great to spend some time with Dick Enberg. Without further ado, the great doctor. Thanks so much. How are you?
Good. It's the third day of the rest of my life.
I was going to say, you've gotten the confetti out of your hair and you're still panting from your victory lap.
Yeah, it was an avalanche of love, the emotional tsunami.
How are you today? I mean, what does this feel like?
Well, I feel like there's 100 things that I'm going to do. There's so much to catch up and clean up. And already this week, I've worked on my play, the Al McGuire play, the one-man act play. Anthony Crivello, who won a Tony Award, is going to replace Cotter Smith because we're doing an eight-week run in Milwaukee in January, February. And we're doing some rewriting on it, trying to add a little more depth, maybe show a little more of the darker side of Coach. That's one of the projects. I'm also working on a potential book on my 10 most memorable moments, not only the importance of the game, but the backside of the story of the, John, all the involvements, the troubles, the laughs, the disappointments, the chuckles, and some of those events did have plenty of that. So that's another. We're building a cabin up in McCall, Idaho, kind of a retreat for the family. After I'm gone, I'm hoping all the kids will be able to go to Grandpa's place there, and it's got everything from archery to figure skating to golf to indoor tennis to all the water sports. So, that's just in the last 2 days.
Someone told me at Wimbledon, I said, I don't remember, it was McAtee or one of our mutual friends, I said, is Mr. Enberg coming? And he said, no, he's traveling. I don't know, he's going to Israel or maybe, sounds like you're doing some, sounds like you'll be doing some traveling as well.
Yeah, traveling is high. Barbara and I love to travel, and this year we've gone to Machu Picchu and a two-week trip to Israel. That was just a mind-boggling experience. And, we've got plenty more on the list. I only have one grandson, two-year-old Archie, and his mom and dad, our daughter, they moved to Rwanda for a two-year job opportunity. So he's a long way away, and we're going to have to go to Rwanda. We've been there before. We trekked with the gorillas. They wanted to keep me, but so we know the land, and we were very impressed by the country. It's really the garden spot of Africa, even though they, of course, had their terrible genocide 23, 24 years ago.
And you're able to do that trip and then go back to National League Baseball and the Marriott in Cincinnati.
Well, that's I always love travel, John. I like being in new places, and even though some of the hotels aren't luscious by any means, and I like to be on an airplane. I get a lot of good thinking time in on an airplane, whether there's no one knocking on the door or ringing the bell. So
That's great.
Yeah, I'm going to miss some of that. I'm going to miss, like the athletes always say, I'm going to miss your colleagues, the people with whom you've worked all this time. But they've really given me a feathery stop, the Padres have. They've kept my office. They call it Dick's Closet because it's so messy. But at least symbolically, it means that I can go back to the ballpark and do some writing or do some voiceover work and leave the baseball door ajar, even though I'm not going to do any play-by-play. And, you know, I'm really excited about what's ahead. I mean, one of my friends said, you know, 60 years of broadcasting, think of it as a high-rise building. You're on the 60th floor, and now you're going to go up to the 61st floor. And there's, you never know how exciting that might be, and I'm really counting upon that.
That's great. I hope you, selfishly, I hope you keep writing. I think you may well be the most deft writer of any TV play-by-play guy. So I hope writing is part of the next chapter.
Well, I accept that as really a rich compliment coming from you, John. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, I was going to ask how someone with your sense of Midwest modesty has been handling these plaudits, well-deserved as they are, in this this tour these past few weeks. But I wanted, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not very comfortable with that, and I never have been. I've never felt, it's my training as my Finnish father and mother. They taught me early on that as soon as you think you're so big that you can't improve, you can only go one way. And don't take yourself that seriously. Just try to be good to people and improve your approach to life. And it's not been easy for me. I never felt that as a broadcaster that, and it was important for me to feel that way. And about all sports, that I've never been more important than the game. I'm just there to complement the game, and hopefully whatever I'm able to offer to a broadcast telecast enhances the experience for the audience. And I'm fortunate, as you are, to sit next to the greatest players in that sport. And it's not only been tennis, but it's been all the sports for me. There have been Hall of Famers rub shoulders with and chew fat with. It'd be like two blokes going to the game and, goodness, look who sat next to me, Merlin Olsen. Oh, Don Drysdale sat next to me. Oh, John McEnroe, how are you? And picking their brain. So that's been part of the excitement of my life. And so all this love that has come by, it's been, you know, it's really been nice. And it's shown me that maybe I should be more open and embrace it. And that a lot of people did care about me and what goes on and in the future and cared about what I gave to them in my 60 years. And I guess that is the ultimate compliment.
Write that book. You mentioned Merlin Olsen. You mentioned John McEnroe. These are analysts. I mean, these are, just to be clear, these are people you're sitting next to in the booth. And I always felt like your versatility was something that was remarkable, but also sort of made, I can't imagine what that was like for you, especially pre-internet, where you weren't just going from event to event, but you were toggling from one sport to a completely different sport in a matter of weeks. How was that by choice? And I'm curious about the preparation when you couldn't just log on to a website and say, oh, yes, that's who Notre Dame basketball is starting this season.
No, but I think that's it goes back to the challenge of being a college professor. I love teaching, and in fact, that may be one of the avenues that I take in the next year or two, go back to campus. Romantically, I'd like to be a sophomore again and get patches on my sports coats on my elbows and be able to walk the campus and enjoy the lectures and music and games and be able to be in a classroom and accept the challenge of the raised hand, which always excited me. And so the preparation was never work. I'd love the preparation. I'd like to take all the time to try to find some nugget or some piece of information or some phrase that might make the broadcast or telecast more interesting. The writing or the interest in various sports really comes all the way back to when I was a kid. I mean, I memorized the sports page. The guys at the fraternity house said, if you want to read the sports page, you better get up earlier than Enberg because he's going to grab it and go to his room, and he reads every page, every column. And so it's been my life. I love, as a fan, I've loved preparing for the fans. And in a way, that's my transformation right now. You know, I'm transforming and going to the student body, the fans. I'm going to be a fan now, and I'm really looking forward to being able to sit in a stadium or sit in front of my television and yell and scream like all the other good people that have supported me all these years.
Still reading the sports page. We'll talk tennis in a second, but I wanted to ask sort of more generically. I'm curious about, I mean, I did a project with Al Michaels, and I know one thing we talked about was retaining dignity, and I think he's done that, I think you've done that, but did you feel as though you had to resist, whether it was coining players with nicknames or hosting game shows? How are you able to avoid sort of the dignity stripping trappings of media in 2016 and stay above the fray?
Well, I don't know how to really answer that. I think being yourself and being honest with yourself and your audience, and I think it really does go back to the traps come in when you try to be more important than the game you're calling. And you try to think, well, maybe if I do this, then I'll get more attention. Maybe I'll get the headline. And I think that there is some of that, and it really began back early in my broadcasting career when the introduction of every newspaper had a TV sports critic, and USA Today had a column every day. And,
right.
And a lot of my colleagues really were concerned about what was said about them in those various columns, and concerned about it or tried to come up with a clever phrase or some incredible outside piece of information that would get their name in the paper. I never wanted to play that game. I didn't think that was healthy at all. And sometimes even I would say to my wife, gosh, I think I had a good telecast this week in the NFL. I wonder why my name's not in there. And she said, well, why don't you call those guys and tell them what you're saying? Maybe they'll put your name in there. Otherwise, don't complain about it. And her point was well taken.
If only Rudy Martsky knew how much power he had.
Wow.
I wanted to ask you about college basketball too, because I think you and I first met when you came to Bloomington. I mean, I think you were getting some award, and you came to Indiana, and I remember that when you and Al McGuire came to town, that was like college football game day. I mean, that was certification. And for years and years, I always associated you with college basketball. Where does that rank when you sort of self-identify and look back on your career? I'm always curious that how do you see yourself?
Well, I'll take a little detour here because I'm asked this often, John. The best sport to broadcast is baseball. It's the most challenging, and it also was the game I tried to play and I cared the most about. The best event is Wimbledon. So we can talk about that if you want later on.
Sure.
And now I've gone off track on this tangent. What was your question?
That's no tangent. No, I'm curious
Well, basketball, you know, because at Central Michigan as another graduate student, I called their games. Then when I earned a graduate assistantship at Indiana, I won the audition for their new IU Sports Network. We were the first announcers. Phil Jones, who was the CBS White House correspondent, was my color man at the time. So I grew through the Big Ten, and that allowed me to call the 1961 NCAA final between Cincinnati and Ohio State. Columbus, Ohio station had heard about my work and said, would you like to do it? And worked it alone.
Wow.
And that was the national telecast. It went to Cincinnati and Ohio State. That was it. And then moving out to the West Coast to coach and teach at Cal State, what is Cal State Northridge now. And eventually Gene Autry hired me in 65. And a year later, Dick Enberg was the solo voice of the UCLA Bruins. And how can you not love college basketball when your first full experience was 9 years calling UCLA games and they won 8 national championships? That's not going to happen again.
I was going to say, I hope you knew that sometimes teams don't win the NCAA title. Actually, you told me, I'll take you, let's do this tangent. You told me a story once about, this is a great story that I don't think people know. Didn't John Wooden get an offer to manage baseball?
Joe Brown, the manager or the owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates, it was early in John Wooden's successful run at UCLA, offered him the managerial job. And he was just getting things really cooking in Westwood, so he felt that was his way of going on for his professional life. But I talked with Coach Wooden. He was 99. We were hoping he'd make it to 100. We went to his apartment that he's lived in for decades, very simple, and still has love letters for his wife, Nell, on the pillow. I hope they're reading them up in heaven today. We knew he wasn't going to last very long. He felt good that day, and we were there maybe an hour and a half or so, and we didn't even talk about basketball. We talked the whole time about baseball. He knew that I had the Padres job, and we started to argue about our left-handed hitting outfield, and Ted Williams was my hero, and he loved Stan Musial, and of course you got to put Babe Ruth in there, and then we argued about all the rest. But he was a pretty good shortstop in his high school days, and tried out with the Cincinnati Reds, hurt his shoulder, throwing arm, and couldn't continue. And that's a blessing for college basketball for certain. No, but he admitted openly baseball was his favorite sport. How about that?
And the Pirates basically said a leader is a leader and a strategist is a strategist, and this wooden guy has the gift, and we can teach him. You know, we'll teach him how to substitute a lefty reliever if that's what it takes. But this guy has the gift.
But John Wooden had Connie Mack written all over him, and I, as you think back, he would have been the next Connie Mack.
Just sort of a dignified sideline presence,
cerebral, tougher discipline than a lot of folks would have known. I mean, he could be very without. Being Al McGuire profane, he could be as tough as anyone. There'd be no question in my mind that he would have done well, although, you know, today's baseball players would eat up any potential leader. But in those days, might have worked. Thank God he stayed at UCLA.
How'd you get Ted Williams to talk to you?
You really want to know that story?
It's a great story. Come on, we got time. It's a podcast.
I grew up on a farm in Michigan, about an hour drive north of Detroit, and Scully and I talked about this, how fortunate we were that we grew up in the days of black and white radio. We were able to use our imagination, and I think those skills learned by just listening to the great announcers of the time, Barber and Allen. Al Heffler and Connie Desmond and Bill Stern and Harry Wismer and all the rest. You made your own game in your mind, and two people could be listening to the same broadcast and seeing two different games. But anyway, the influence of those voices and how they painted the picture certainly played into our careers, and Ben and I both agreed to that. So anyway, Ted Williams... I don't know why initially, I guess the fact I go all the way back to when he, in 1946 All-Star Game, I was 11 years old, and we were driving after the war, World War II, and listening on the radio to the All-Star Game, and Ted Williams hit a home run off the Epus pitch, and I think he hit two home runs in that game, and I guess that started my interest in him. And then because he was such an incredible character in the public eye, and the fact he was maybe the best hitter ever, I tried to be like him. I tried to hit left-handed and would bat rocks on the farm left-handed to try to improve my skills. So anyway, I hitchhiked to Detroit as a high school student. Anytime Boston came to town to see Ted Williams play against the Tigers and hit in Briggs Stadium. And as old fans will recall, the Tigers became Tiger Stadium. The right field overhang in the second deck made it a really short porch. It was 325 down the line, but the overhang actually, Kurt Gibson said, if you were on the front edge of the warning track, the edge closest to home plate, a ball could be in the air going above your head and you'd lose it in the overhang. That's how far out it extended. Anyway, I would go and hitchhike down. We knew where the players stayed, the Book Cadillac Hotel in downtown Detroit. And you always could pick them out when they came out of the hotel, because in those days they all wore those wingtip brown, white, or black and white shoes. And one day here comes Pinky Higgins, the manager of the Red Sox, and Williams come out of the hotel. And we followed them. And they walked up Michigan Avenue from the hotel to the stadium. And my buddy and I followed them. If they stopped, we'd stop. If they looked in the window, we would look in the window, but never getting close enough to ask for an autograph. No, that would have been beyond belief for us at the time. And we would just shadow them all the way to the ballpark. And by the time they got there, I mean, it didn't matter. We saw the game or batting practice. We were so excited to be that close to the splendid splinter. And then you go to the batting practice, and It's a shame that we've kind of, in today's world, shut off batting practice to the fans. The players want more time off. They don't take infield, and the batting practice is so much earlier. But Ted Williams taking batting practice was the greatest cellist in the world rehearsing for a concert at Carnegie Hall. I mean, he was he never hit the ball poorly. Every ball that he swung at, he hit sharply. And he would tear apart right field in Detroit. When the game started, I mean, it was an easy home run for him to bang one into that upper deck in right field. In fact, as we became friends later in life, because I'm back in San Diego, Ted of San Diego would come back for various banquets and sorts. And I finally said, well, hey, Ted, if you, when you were 38, 39, and of course he came within seven hits of hitting 400 when he was 39 or 40.
Right.
I said, we all dreamed that, you know, since you hit so well in Detroit, that you get traded to the Tigers. And just out of curiosity, if you'd have become a Tiger, even at that age, how many home runs would you have hit in a season? He said 80. He didn't even let me finish this. 80 home runs, and I believe it. Anyway, he was my idol, and for him to recognize me late in my career is the completion of such a beautiful cycle that you can have a hero, and maybe even sometime the hero will get to know you.
He was a, you know what they say about him too, but when they say better fisherman, better fly fisherman than hitter.
He was
two
a perfectionist.
Sports.
He was a perfectionist. I don't doubt that, but I don't stand on the banks of the river to cheer any fly fisherman.
Yeah, exactly.
But I cheer.
well put. All right, let's talk tennis. 28 Wimbledons, I believe. And you said that's your favorite event to cover?
It is. It's the best event because, you know, all the other great championships in the other sports last only a long weekend or a full week. But Wimbledon is 2 weeks. The fortnight allows you to truly embrace this event. And the fact that you're in that cathedral of tennis and the grass court and the manner in which the British pay honor to this, their big summertime event. And the fact that it's not just a men's event, it's the greatest players, men and women, are seeking this coveted title that will secure their place in history. The fact that it's all the history. I mean, it goes on and on. And, you were very complimentary, John, about writing. I can write a little bit when I'm in love with something. And I think that's true of almost everyone. We can, we're all a poet when we fall in love with a person or a thing. People like you, John, are the real writers. Can write about something they don't like. I can't do that. I can't write the letter to somebody and say, I don't love you anymore. But I can write a pretty good one if I love it. And I fell in love with Wimbledon the very first time they sent me over in 1979. And Bud Collins and Donald L. were doing the telecast then. And they just sent me over. I was, in NBC's eyes, their number one man at the time. And they just wanted, since they were going to televise the event live for the first time, they wanted my presence there with Bud and Donald, and Bud could have destroyed me. He could see that I was eventually going to probably move him over a chair, but he was as generous as he's been to everyone that shows any love for the game of tennis, much less Wimbledon. And he helped me that very first year to see it and feel it, and that's because they didn't know quite what to do with me. They said, well, why don't you just watch a lot of the tennis? You can do the commercials and do the opens and closes. And then at the end, take as much time as you want and write your memories of your first.
No, and that's how they it all let started. You, that's what I mean, they let you really write the heck out of it, didn't they?
Oh, well, because, you know, here's the good fortune, John. As you know, we're, today's world, television is, can you do it? We'll give you 3 minutes, but show a little more emotion and try to cut it to two.
Yeah,
but
right,
in those
right.
days, the finals had a block of 6 hours on NBC. Well, the final, even the best of the finals only might go 3.5-4 hours. They had 2 hours to fill, and they'd fill it with backup video of the women's final or the mixed doubles or the doubles. And so they said, write as much as you want, and we'll see what you have, and if we like it, we'll just back time the end of the show to your memories. So let's say I wrote sometimes 13, 15 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And so they would just say, okay, just back off 13, 15 from the end of the show. We'll time everything to Enbrick's memories. How lucky is that to be fortunate to be able to, you know, Let it all flow.
You're making me very jealous. And I don't think we have images of that, so let's cut it down to 145. No,
okay,
that's right. and you, I mean, McEnroe Borg, which is, I don't know if you saw this, which is now being turned into a movie. I mean, all the classic matches year after year, and you were right there. I also don't know if people get this sense anymore of where the booth is, but do you want to explain where you are on set? But I don't know if television today really conveys it in a way that it used to. I mean, do you want to explain where you're watching these Wimbledon finals from on center court?
Well, there was that cramped little, it was the back end of the old scoreboard, and we would squeeze in behind the people keeping score. In those days, it wasn't digital, and there was room, actually, they had these little thin glass windows that made terrible noise when you tried to slide them open and close, and in fact, whenever we did an opening on the show, especially with Chris and John, the three of us, there was only room for two chairs in there, so the three of us had to cuddle up and use our butts on two chairs in order to get in that little window so that they could take the shot of the three of us for our limited on cameras. It was intimate at best, and I hate to think of what was in there in the other 50 weeks or the year.
Exactly.
But and we're right next to the Royal Box. I mean, if you were as you look at the Royal Box from the far side, immediately to the left and down, that was the corner where the broadcast location existed. And I can remember one time, part of the problem was we'd be at center court, and that was our only position. But the best match was over on court one. So they would be shooting the action on court one, and we would be calling it from center court. Well, meanwhile, on center court, there's another match being engaged. And one time, it's a very exciting match over in court one, and I'm shouting my oh my's and all the rest. And right in the middle of our telecast, this beautiful English woman, elderly woman, comes over. She's sitting down the row in front of us, because we're literally in the next row of stands if they didn't have the booth. And she's standing in front of our window and knocking on it with her fist and saying, young man, if you don't tone it down, I'm calling the police. Oh, my. So that was kind of the unprofessional situation we were in. Now they have those booths up high, tucked under the roof center court. Not quite as much fun up there.
I love that, though. And wouldn't you say, wouldn't you rather have that, cramped as it may have been, over the booth way the heck over above the 50-yard line, or even the U.S. Open booth that's, I'm sure, more spacious but quite a bit of distance from the court?
Yeah, the U.S. Open booth is about as ideal. I mean, it's not too high, and it's perfectly located, probably the best broadcast location of the four majors. But you're right. The struggles of the old days when everything wasn't perfect made it all the more interesting for us, and better stories certainly occurred out of that. There was another working with McEnroe, and I probably, Chris was in there too, maybe Tracy Austin at the time, and you'll know the story, and you'll know the exact number. I'm saying 1997, Richard Washington, now Washington, and Richard Krychek.
Does sure.
That sound right? 96.
Yeah, 96.
It was the two long shots. Krychek had beaten Pete Sampras, who was winning all the Wimbledons at that time. And so Krychek from the Netherlands and Mel Washington, a long shot American. And we come on the air maybe 10 minutes before the match begins. And that was the year that the well-endowed Wimbledon barmaid, the 23-year-old barmaid, decided to streak center court. And, of course, I've been taught, if it's somebody running on the court or there's something away from the action that isn't appropriate, ignore it. You just go ahead as if it isn't happening. And so I'm doing the usual sacred tones of center court Wimbledon and these two long shot stars who get their opportunity to win treasured Wimbledon. I'm talking in these tones. And she jumps out down to the right of our booth and then runs all the way across the center court toward the Royal Box end. And I'm going on in this tone and that tone. I said, She's naked. Get a shot over there. She's right up on that now. That's it. Just
totally blows my cover. I'm trying to pretend it's not happening. And McEnroe is screaming to the world to take a shot of this woman who was rather attractive. In fact, I think five or six bobbies fought over who was
going to arrest her. Exactly.
And the Duke was up there with a big smile and that unusual clap of his. I think he enjoyed it, too. Even there was a notice out of the All England Club the next day. It was a very wet Wimbledon, you shall recall. And they said, in light of the dismal conditions that the weather has brought to this fortnight, a bit of levity actually was a bright light, and something to that effect.
I remember, yeah, exactly. It's a little different than the fan that runs on to left field and has to deal with Angel Pagan or whoever it was. But I remember, I will not repeat it on the air, but Mal Washington had one of the all-time great sports quotes in conjunction with that event that I encourage people to look it up. How is
that? Wait a minute. Now you got at least to text me that or let me know. I'll
mail it to you offline. This is okay. Google's your friend here, but I need to keep my job. I said half an hour. We're at the half hour mark. So let me just sort of ask in closing, let's stick with tennis. And what do you see going forward for this sport as sort of the virtues and the challenges from where you stand and from your involvement in the sport all these years? I mean, where do you see tennis in the sportscape and where do you see it going from here?
Boy, that's, I think the game has improved. The players certainly are better and better. I rue a bit at the equipment changes have made it such a different game.
Right.
Now, Rod Laver lives here in Southern California. In fact, he was nice enough to come to the ceremonies at the Petco Park the other night. And I think about him with that wooden racket, or McEnroe even with his Woody, and how they were able to maneuver the ball and how they were able to play the game at such a high level. And it wasn't always a power. The delicate nature of the game is also something to behold. I don't know how you change all that. Golf has done the same thing with a ball. And it's the balls and the rackets, and it's the balls and the clubs in golf. People want power. They want that apparently excites them more. And we're playing to the power players, and that's why I think Roger Federer really could have played with that wooden racket and still have been one of the greatest of all time, if not the greatest of all time. That he didn't need to have the hyped up balls or whatever, or the rackets as we know them today. I think he would even he could have, for most of his opponents, he could have given them any racket they wanted. He could have taken a real good Woody and probably given them a good game.
I'll take the frying pan. Ah, that's great. I like that we close with from one classic to another. I wish you a lot of travel. Enjoy being a fan, but I do hope that we get some more writing from you.
Well, that's kind of you, John. I enjoy your work. Keep it up.
Thanks so much. Good luck and congrats.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. That's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. That, of course, was Dick Enberg. I could have talked to that man all day, or more accurately, I could have sat here and just listened to his stories. That's my kind of guy. What a lovely human being. What a skilled announcer. What a lovely writer. If you haven't seen the Al McGuire play, or if you don't know about it, we should have paused maybe for a moment and referenced that. Along with the coach Al McGuire, Dick Enberg, they were the two voices of college basketball for NBC in a long time in the 80s. And after Al McGuire passed away, Dick Enberg helped write a play about McGuire that will be touring. I think they've had some limited shows in San Diego and Milwaukee, but that may well come to you. I'd encourage you to keep an eye on it. Keep an eye out for Dick Enberg's book. And boy, I tell you, they don't make them like that anymore. Just a lovely guy, and I was happy to have spent half an hour hearing his stories again. Could have made the rest of the afternoon. Would you agree with that, Jamie Lasanti?
I agree.
Thank you. All right, that's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. This is a happier podcast, would you not agree, Jamie Lasanti, than discussing the ins and outs of Maria Sharapova and her 15-month ban reduction for a banned substance. Thank you, Dick Enberg. You are the disinfectant on the Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast this week. We'll have a new guest next week. Keep the ideas coming. Feel free to keep the feedback, criticism, constructive or otherwise coming. All feedback is always welcome and read. And we'll do it again in 7 days. Have a good week, everyone. Again, I'm John Wertheim. That's Jamie Lasanti. We were thrilled to have spent a few moments with Dick Enberg. Talk to you next week. We'll be right back.